Welcome to the Groovy Uncle Podcast with me, Glenn Prangnell. The Groovy Uncle Podcast takes a look at the creative output of a prolific bunch of musicians and artists based in the Medway towns. Each week, I'll be catching up with some friends, old and new, to talk about what projects they've been involved in over the years and what they're doing now.
You're listening to the Groovy Uncle Podcast.
So let's dive into the soup of groovy uncleness. My guest today is a musician, songwriter, drummer and co-founder of the superb music magazine Shindig. He's made some truly excellent records with Bronco Bullfrog and been a member of bands such as The Nerve, Vibraphone, Little Bear, Big Bear and The Groove Garden, and wrote the song She'll Never Be Mine for the Groovy Uncle album, meanwhile back in medieval Britain. So it may be surprising to learn that we'd never actually met until we recorded this interview. So let's say hello to Andy Moore.
It's what you do.
Andy Morton, welcome.
Thank you, Glenn Prangnell.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. Life goes on and all that. No, I'm all right.
So, my first question is always the same. How have you been doing the last 18 months or so?
I'm okay. I'm still here. I've been working hard. I've been trying to apply myself to things. I've been at home a lot. I've been watching a lot of movies and drinking a lot of beer. I've let the music go a little bit, but the magazine's been a saviour and my other work's been good. And we've weathered the storm, really. My son's all right. My wife's had the COVID, but she's getting over it now. I think it's been a time for sort of keeping an eye on my friends and my nearest and dearest as much as worrying about myself, to be honest.
So the stuff you've done, the bands you've been in, the Shindig magazine, all that stuff, there's a lot of ground to cover. Where did it all start for you?
Music-wise, wow. Okay, I'll try and compress this. The reason I think that you and I are having this conversation is because at some point in the mid-80s, I found myself as a teenager, I was dragged up in a small town in Northamptonshire. I found myself in a situation where I was getting into sort of quite oddball music and through various older friends. And I did the thing where it was all the Jam and Dexys and Madness, right, at school. And then I got into the older stuff, and then the older stuff led into me discovering the Prisoners. And that was a big deal. So at 15, I was hopping on a train with a couple of mates and going down to see the Prisoners. Probably the last year they were together. Saw them about 20 times in a year. Anything I could do, I did.
You know they got back together the other night. You know that, do you?
I heard. I saw the videos on Friday, yes. So, yeah, we went to see them, and then suddenly you've got the Headcoats and you've got the Daggermen and you've got all these other bands. And I started buying records, I suppose, that maybe fall under that Medway umbrella, including the Craven A's album, Crave On. Wow. So I think that's the first time I started really joining the dots and figuring out that a lot of you guys were in each other's bands and there was a heritage and there was, I'm not going to use the word scene because we know about that now, but it really appealed to me and I was still figuring out getting into old stuff, getting into 60s stuff and new wave stuff and trying to pick up on new bands. But I'm stuck in a little town in the middle of nowhere and it's, you know, 1986 or something and it wasn't ideal. So I think what happened to me was I went backwards and I went kind of inwards and started obsessing about 60s beat groups and psychedelic bands and little things, little weird things, picking singles up for 10p in record shops and then just slowly starting to piece it all together before the internet and all that. And you bought records because they had, you know, this name on this producer or something. So that was me. And then I got a drum kit and I joined a band and I started trying to do it myself. And here I am, 35 years later, still trying to do it myself. I used to go to Northampton to a record shop called, I think it was called Selector Disc. I think it's one of those chain with no name places. I just started buying things. I knew about the Creation and the Action and I had, you know, some basic stuff. I just started buying psych comps and I veered very much towards the British pop stuff rather than the American garage, which a lot of my friends went for. And then what happened, the timing was perfect because what happened then was all these reissues started coming out, all these anthologies. It was like the dawn of the compilation. So I'd go and I'd get the Idle Race and Honeybus and Blossom Toes and the Pretty Things psychedelic stuff. And the timing was immaculate and that really consumed me. And that's really all I wanted to do. So when I did finally get into a band with two or three people that were pretty much like-minded, by that point we were all sharing music, taping music and sharing music. That's sort of the road we went down. You know, we were covering Father's Name Is Dad and William Chalker's Time Machine, Magic Potion by the Open Mind. So that was definitely our thing.
Did you ever have a sense of no one's going to get this? No one's going to know what we're...
I wish I would. I was that self-aware. I just don't think we gave a shit. I don't think any of us knew.
Well, that's probably the better way to be.
Yeah, that ignorance thing that you've only got when you're 18 is brilliant. So we just went and played gigs in rough old pubs in the county, around Wellingborough and Kettering and Northampton, and just turned up with our flowery shirts on and our Chelsea boots and played this stuff. I think the significant thing probably, which again feeds into you and I talking now, is that purely by coincidence and default, I became the guy that started writing all the songs. And I was playing drums, and that was a bit weird, but none of the others showed any interest or any promise particularly. And I started, and so I started writing songs for the band in that vein, very much in that vein. A band called The Nerve, that was all very much informed by the kind of late 60s UK psych stuff. But people would come and see us, and I suppose they joined, that they looked at it and maybe thought, oh, they sound like whatever was going on at the time. They said, oh, they sound like the Charlatans, or they sound like Hendrix, or they sound like something that we can identify with. And we did all right when we got, you know, we did quite well. We ended up coming to play in London, and then we ended up playing with the bands that I was a fan of, because we were all end up, or you end up, you remember, you all end up on the same circuit. So it was the same circuit. Sometimes you just get like four people and your girlfriend, and you know, you didn't let the dog in for free, did you? It was that sort of thing. Yeah. So, I mean, what really brings this round for me is that because of the nature of the music that we do, in inverted commas, we started playing shows with guys that had been in the bands whose record I had. So we ended up playing with the Solar Flares and playing with them. I don't think we ever played with any of your bands, but I do remember coming to see I don't know if it was a Good Child or a Craven A show. I was very young and very drunk at the time. I can't remember. But that was really nice. That was some affirmation for us, I suppose, that we're playing on the same circuit as all these guys now. And I met a lot of people that are still around, and a lot of those people have ended up writing for us at Shindig, and they're mates now.
Give me a little run through of the bands that you've been in over the years.
Oh, blimey, Glenn. It was covers. It was 60s covers when I was a teenager. Then we had a band called The Groove Garden, which was riffing off the back of the sort of baggy, pre-baggy sort of sound, but we were doing Hendrix covers and stuff, but we had that down, digga down, digga down, digga down, down thing, which actually I got from The Prisoners, of course, everyone did.
Hush.
We still call it hush drumming to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Down, digga down, digga down, 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 down.
Yeah, write a song like that. Write 10 songs like that.
We had hush drumming or Motown drumming, and that was all you needed, right? So we did that. Then we had The Nerve, which was when we started really, I started writing songs, and we thought a little bit more about it, and we started getting better gigs and going and playing in London and meeting people. And that was great. Got a few singles out, never did an album. Then that finished. We're up to about, where are we up to now? We're probably up to sort of mid 90s, I guess. Then Mike and I from The Nerve, Mike was a good friend, still is. We met when we both lived in Northamptonshire, and there weren't a lot of kind of mod looking 60s looking guys around, so we naturally waved at each other on the train one night and became mates. He and I wanted to be in a band doing the same sort of thing, and the other two guys, I can't really remember what happened, but anyway, they weren't around anymore. And I met Louis, who'd been in bands, he'd been in the Beat Pack when he was like six or something. Outrageous stuff. There's photos of him with his hair down here and his leopard skin waistcoat on. Just amazing. So we'd met him, and he was into the same stuff as us, and so we thought, well, why don't we try and get a band together that isn't necessarily a garage band or a beat group or anything. We just, let's throw it all in, let's throw the Raspberries in and the country stuff that we're starting to listen to, and the Association and all the bands that we really, really loved. Anything goes, right? But we started trying to do that. But at the end of the day, it was three lads making a racket with some guitars and some drums and all trying to harmonize and trying to sing. And that was Bronco Bullfrog. So that started 96, and we did that for about, I think, about 7 or 8 years.
But later on, you got back together, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We packed that in. It just ran its course. The love was kind of running out of that, and then we got back together. This seems quite new, but it's probably about 9 years ago or something. We got back together just because we got over whatever the problems were. and started recording some 45s. And we went to Mole's when he was at Sandgate, Mole and Marty's studio at Sandgate before they moved out of there. And just started writing like pairs of songs to put out as singles. And I think we ended up putting about five singles out.
Norman Jones is late for church because his neighbors left him in the lurch. To steal a bottle of their fizzy pop. Jackdaws shitting on his car, the children's footprints in the sticky tar. Amen. Someone's got their radio tuned in to hear the nation's favourite show.
Bronco Bullfight. In the meantime, I suppose along the way, I've had other bands with mates, and I had a band in London for a little while with John that I now do Shindig with called Little Bear Big Bear, which was more of a kind of acid rock sort of stuff, I suppose, which I played guitar in that band. And they're just these bits and bobs along the way. I mean, you know what it's like if your mate says, oh, can you come and play drums? We need a bass player. I was always the guy that would go, yeah, all right. And then I tried to muddle my way through that. When I moved to Somerset 15 years ago, I met some mates and we just started doing covers in the pubs. And that's it, really, apart from a couple of deviations, which I might have forgotten about.
And a lot of it doesn't seem very long ago, and yet, actually, it is.
It's when Facebook tells you that your white label test pressings of your album arrived 12 years ago.
Yeah.
It's that stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we did the Groovy Uncle 10 years, I think, and I know it's 10 years, you know, and I know we've released something each year, but when I stand back from it, like now, I think, how the hell Can it be 10 years?
It is. And I, it doesn't seem that long ago. And I remember it vividly because I remember they not long had State Records going and the single came through the office here at Shindig because we know Mole by now. And thinking, who's this? Oh, it's the lad that was in Good Child and Mole's doing it and his mate and he's got Thingy out of that other band on it. And that was my first introduction to your Groovy Uncle stuff. I suppose with State Records starting around the same time that you started recording with Mole, you ended up like sort of like a, what's it called? A, you know, symbiotic relationship where he could put your records out and you could make them together, and suddenly you've almost got this in-house thing going on.
Yeah, it just sort of happened like that. It was a very enjoyable time, but it was an accident. There wasn't any big plan. I didn't know that was going to happen. Didn't see that one coming, as they say. Anyway, so with the various bands you've been in, what would you pick out as your favourite songs that you've either recorded or not recorded? What are your favourite musical moments over the years?
When Bronco Bullfrog first got together, that was new and exciting, and it was anything goes, and it was very liberating after all the bands we've been in before. And the way our first LP, as it ended up being, came about was that we used to save up some money. So by this point, I'm living in Leicester with Louis in a house share. And Mike's in Northampton, which is only down the road. So we were together a lot. And we'd save up. And when we got to 50 quid each, we'd go and book the studio in the YMCA and record three songs. So we had to have three songs ready to go and rehearsed every, I suppose, 3 months, maybe. I think we did one gig or something around that time. Get 150 quid, three songs, go into the studio for 10 hours or something. And it dawned on us that when we had 12 songs that we liked as well, that maybe there was something in it. And completely by coincidence, Twist Records got in touch with Louis and asked him whether his former band, The Immediates, had anything that could be released. And he said, no, but I've got a new band. I think they gave us a little bit of money and we went and did another session. And that was the first Bronco Bullfrog album, which ended up being quite big, 15, 16 songs. It's the classic first album thing for me in terms of, to answer your question, a lot of the songs that are the most important to me and the ones that I will stand by till my dying day are on that first record. There's one called Greenacre Hill that I like a lot. That's probably like the one that I'm sort of most proud of. And that's like the second song we ever recorded. Ridiculously overambitious. It's a really super musical track.
Not long ago when we were young, and every morning held a new surprise that sparkled in our eyes. Ride our bikes across the field, throwing pebbles in a winding stream, and living in a dream with no thoughts about tomorrow to get in our way. I wish it could still be that day. You'll never find this kind of happiness again. You'll never know how slow your life has really been. Our ball's gone over next door's fence,
The second album, we did four albums, and I'd say it was diminishing returns after that. And again, this is quite common with bands, right? You sort of, it's all that. In fact, we've had all our lives to build up to our first record, and then we've run out of ideas for the others. It wasn't quite that extreme, but after that, I'm less enamored of them and the songs. Another song I really like of mine called Sunday Wheeling, which is on the fourth Bronco Bullfrog album, which we recorded in Madrid, which is that's a really good song, but it's an emotional one. It's from a breakup. Got a lot of mileage out of that breakup. You know, could have done an album, I reckon.
That you never really thought that much about me. Now that I have found my space, baby, well, it all falls into place. If you're feeling like Sunday wheeling without me, you'll better believe it if you don't believe in me. Believe it.
that's just Bronco Bullfrog stuff, and very proud of most of that stuff, but I say those were the important ones for me. And then since we got back together in the last few years, these singles we've been doing, there's a couple of tracks on those singles that, again, I would play to somebody. If they said, so what's your music like then, Andy? I would play a couple of those things. But really, in terms of me as a songwriter and me being most proud of my own work, it's all been with that band. My first connection to any of the Medway musicians, like I said, I think Bronco Bullfrog played with the Solar Flares at the Blow Up Club in Soho one night. Then we played with the, I can't remember what band that might have been. We played with them again, North London somewhere. And that was really the first time that I properly stood with a pint in my hand and spoke to Graham and Alan to any extent other than, I really like your records, mate, and then running off. That was the first time I spoke to them about like what was going on and life and all the other stuff, which was significant. So until you came into my life, you
sounds a bit dodge.
with this stuff that ended up on the meanwhile back in medieval Britain, I didn't have any connections to you guys. So possibly, am I the only podcast guest that you've never met?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously we know each other via the internet, but we've never met in person and we've never spoken until today. But when I was putting together the Medieval Britain album, I thought it might be a nice touch to have some other songwriters involved, which on the surface sounds as though, I didn't have enough songs, but I did. But I just thought it might be interesting to get other people involved.
It worked out really well, and I completely sympathise when, with Bronco Bullfrog, I was the primary songwriter, but occasionally Louis more than Mike, they'd say, well, I've written one. And we'd work it out. And I found it really liberating playing someone else's song. And we even got to the point where we were taking different instruments, just like, I'll play bass on this one. So the whole thing felt like it wasn't just my songs with that format, with those same three people every time. And I really welcomed that after a while, possibly to the point where it became such a democratic union in the end, where we kind of carved up the songwriting. Classic teenage fan club style, right? You get three, you get three, you get three, and then we'll do three between us. Possibly by the end of all of that, it might have backfired a little bit and we might have lost a little bit of our punch. But, you know, you never know until you play around with the songs, do you?
Well, that's right. I mean, you've got to try these things. And sometimes, well, a lot of the time, I prefer when someone takes the lead vocal on my songs because it's like listening to a proper record. You know, you can distance yourself from it and it has more impact.
It's a different relationship. Something that I found fascinating about your records when you started collaborating with Miss Modus and Susie, was that you sort of stepped out of a traditional band leader, singer, frontman role into a more of a kind of a, almost where you're becoming more like a songwriter, producer. You know, and you've got in the, and I know that a lot of the music you love was born out of that approach. You know, it's like I've got some songs and I've got some ideas and I've got a band and whatever, but I want these people to sing the songs and take it to some other level that maybe I couldn't get to.
Not everyone, I know, not everyone is happy about standing back and saying you sing it, I'll play the tambourine. But I'm perfectly happy with that. It doesn't bother me at all. Much as I like singing and doing backing vocals because I like harmonies and stuff, I'll do the other stuff. I'm quite happy to, but I like to stand back. I don't know if that's unusual, but I do like to go, yeah, you do it. You have that song. You'll do it better than me.
But you've already mentioned that, you know, you like the process and you know, you're as interested in the song craft and the writing and the putting the tracks together as it being about you in any way. I think that's important. I remember now, until this, I don't think any of my songs had been recorded by other people, but then I remembered that I was in another band I'd completely forgotten about called Vibraphone for a little while with Louis. They were a Hastings band, and we didn't record anything while I was in them. We recorded a rehearsal once, just, you know, as you did in those days, on cassette, and it found its way into the hands of a friend of mine's girlfriend who was in a band in Barcelona called the Flashback Five, and they covered a song that I'd written that I could only record it on a rehearsal tape, a practice with, you know, and it ended up being on their album. And nobody even told me. I didn't know about this for years, and then turned up much later on. And that was really thrilling hearing somebody else. It was completely unusual. One Bronco Bullfrog got going. A couple of clips turned up on YouTube of bands covering our songs in their live shows. And again, I thought, that's mental. Why would you do that? You've got the entire canon of recorded music out there and you've plumped for one of ours. So I found that extremely flattering and liberating. And then when I first heard the recording of my song, that was like, you know what? I'm almost glad I couldn't make the session on that one because I don't know what I would have done. I literally would have stood at the back with the tambourine.
No, it's a shame you couldn't come down because I was really looking forward to that, apart from anything else, having a few beers and whatnot, which is always my favourite part of the day. So you were happy with that, what we did with that?
Absolutely thrilled.
When we came up with the idea of doing that, I thought, great, yeah, we do that. Didn't think much about it other than that'll be great. And then when we was recording, I thought, this is a bit of a responsibility because we might do this. We're all, Mull was there and we're going, yeah, this sounds great. And then I'm thinking, yeah, but what if he doesn't like it? Because there's always that chance, you know.
I suppose there's a chance, but also the way I see it is that if you're you know, working at the level that I'm at in my musical trajectory, then anybody taking the slightest bit of interest in anything I've done, never mind actually saying, Andy, I like this song, can we do it? Is I'd be a dick and a diva and an idiot and a prick of the massive order to even raise my voice at anything. You know, you would have had to really have balls that up, Glenn, before I would have said anything. And I was properly thrilled when I heard that, even the rough mixes and stuff. It was a real pleasure.
Men with
tell you a funny little story about that song. It's called She'll Never Be Mine, right? About 4 years ago, we were trying to get another Bronco Bullfrog album together. So I started writing and I started gathering some old stuff and just collating demos, you know. And I demoed that one. And I think I handed over about a dozen songs to the boys in the end. And that was the only one they didn't like.
Strange, isn't it?
Weird. They are weird, though.
Interestingly, you say that. After Medieval Britain came out, I did have a lot of people saying, and people that didn't realise, they hadn't looked at who wrote it, they just assumed it was me wrote them all again. I just said, oh, the number of people said, I really like, my favourite is She'll Never Be Mine. I'm going, oh, thanks. It's the other way round. People thought that was, what a great track that is.
It seems like a mutually beneficial situation, right?
Yeah, that was great. I'd have to do that sort of thing again. That was really good.
I think we should. We should have a conversation about this. We've touched on it since the recording was done, but it's. I think I need to get my finger out and make some music again. I've made some faltering steps during lockdown, but they've not led anywhere so far. I've been so many ways with it. I recorded a load of drums at a mate's studio in Froome a few years ago and for a thing that never happened. And I've got all these quite well-recorded drum tracks. And the irony is that I've forgotten all the songs that they were supposed to relate. I basically went in and drummed on my own with the monologue, you know, with no headphones or anything. I just drummed along to these songs I'd written and nothing came of any of them. And the drums actually sound pretty good and there's quite a lot of them. And I keep thinking, I wonder if I map out the drums like and write down a little chart and a bit of paper, whether I could actually craft a song to fit the pattern that I played on the drums for a song that I have absolutely no memory of, no lyrics for, no demo of. Christ knows how I did that or why. So I did at one extreme, I've got all that stuff going on. And then at the other, I have tried to record myself in the rehearsal room just on a laptop and stuff, and I hated it and I didn't like the way it turned out, so I haven't done it again.
Let's go back to your childhood.
I wish I had one of those kind of, it was T-Rex or David Bowie on Top of the Pops things. I was probably a little bit too young. I was born in 1969, and the first thing I really remember, it was Top of the Pops and the radio. Honestly, the first thing I remember of any importance, I'm sure I'd seen the Wurzels and Pilot doing magic on Top of the Pops. I'm sure I'd seen it all. It was bound to have happened. But the first thing I saw on Top of the Pops that I really thought I really liked, and then I started trying to understand what it was, and then I found out what records were and how the whole thing worked, was Blondie. So that probably makes me quite old. I don't think they had any British hits till 78, so I would have been 9. I think Denis is the first UK hit, so I probably was 9. Whether that was the fact that it's that I love them, adore them to this day, they're like almost the perfect band to me. Whether it was that, partly obviously it was Debbie Harry, partly it was the childish nature of the song.
It was definitely Debbie Harry.
Flippin' heck. That was definitely a big one for me, and I love them still. I adore those records. I worship them. But obviously, I watched Top of the Pops in the mid-70s growing up, like all of us did, so I must have. But nothing really made much of an impact on me, I don't think, until that. And then I started noticing, like, I basically call them, like, new wave bands. I started paying more attention, I think, to, like, the Stranglers and the Undertones. I remember being on Top of the Pops and really liking that, and not really liking the disco stuff.
But I suppose if you were born in 69, that means in the mid-70s, although there's always good stuff and there's always bad stuff, but in the mid-70s, that pre-punk thing, there was a lot of dross. So you might have seen a lot. It was mum and dad music and a lot of novelty and... I mean, not always, obviously not always, but you might have just been thinking, oh, this is shit. And then suddenly you see Debbie Harry. So it's going to have a, whoa, hang on a minute. And then the Stranglers.
That's very true. I think you're right. After, I mean, you know, everyone, the people that are slightly older than me, possibly yourself, who kind of remember glam rock being, and Bowie and Bolan and everything.
Because this is the thing, people get this rose-tinted view of the 70s. You know, I was born in 63, so I was kind of old enough to remember the reality of it. I remember watching the Top of the Pops, bearing in mind I was a teenager, and I'm finding Top of the Pops embarrassing a lot of the time. You know, people now go, oh, it was great. And it wasn't. I found it embarrassing a lot of the time. Again, not all of the time, but, you know.
With the greatest respect to my parents, I didn't have any schooling at home. People that have got cool parents or groovy uncles, I'm so jealous of them because my mum and dad, bless them, but it was Kenny Rogers and Crystal Gayle and I think, and Carpenters, and they had like a Best of Glen Campbell album. And when the Beatles' 20 Greatest Hits tape came out, which I've subsequently found out because I wanted to know when it was, and it came out in 1980, probably, possibly off the back of John Lennon's murder. They bought that and that was in the car for the whole year. And that was the first sort of thing I knew. But my parents, I had no musical education from my parents really whatsoever. Ironically, now I love Glen Campbell and the Carpenters, of course, because I appreciate what incredibly skillful music.
But when you're a kid, it's mum and dad music, isn't it?
It's hideous. I hated everything. I hated even what they listened to on the radio. So after Blondie and guitar bands, I do remember Adam and the Ants, liking Adam and the Ants a lot.
What was the first album you ever bought with your own money?
Interesting you should ask me that, Glenn. It was Kings of the Wild Frontier by Adam and the Ants, which I think came out in 1980, which would have made me 10 or 11.
So what was the first single?
I think... immediately after that, Stand and Deliver, which went straight in at number one. I fundamentally didn't understand that when you put Top of the Pops on, at number one this week was Althea and Donna with Uptown Top Ranking, that the reason that record was on Top of the Pops and they were number one is because you went out to a shop and bought a single with your pocket money. I didn't know that. And when I went out and realised that you could buy albums and records, and somebody said, well, you know, if they sell 1,500 million copies of this, it will get to number one. That it was at that point that the penny dropped. I know there was no correlation between the TV and the radio and me going and buying Adam and the Ants records when I was 10 or 11, absolutely none. And then I suppose after that, I didn't really know what to do. I think we, you know, goofed about not really knowing what to do with music and just enjoying hearing stuff. And then it was the Jam for me. It was absolutely the Jam for me. A mate of mine had a couple of Jam singles. He might have had Setting Suns and he was a year older than me. And we went bunked off school and went to his house and he played them to me. And I don't know whether it was the fact that it chimed a little bit with the guitar bands that I'd been enjoying on Top of the Pops. I don't know whether I just liked his songs. I certainly found the whole thing quite thrilling. And the visual aspects and the swearing on some of the lyrics was very thrilling to an 11, 12-year-old. I guess that was really the first band that I would say that I loved and I became obsessed by. And then I became, you know, a mod and a Jam fan. And then they split up. Selfish bastards.
That first single I bought was My Love by Paul McCartney and Wings, 1973. 73 was the year I started going, you know, with my own money, going into shops. So I was 10. First ones, I remember the first handful of records. It was My Love by Wings. Then it was Rubber Bullets by 10cc. Then it was Life on Mars, David Bowie. Yesterday Once More, The Carpenters. One of the earliest was Ghetto Child by the Detroit Spinners.
Even though stylistically they're all fairly different, what connects them is at the heart of all of them is a really, really, really good song.
Exactly. And that's what I've always been attracted to. It doesn't matter. I'm not interested in genre. A good tune's a good tune. This or That. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Poem or novel?
Novel.
Chips or rice?
Chips.
The Naked Chef or The Galloping Gourmet?
I have been watching quite a lot of Jamie during lockdown, actually, so I'm going to have to stick with The Naked Chef on that one.
Kate Bush or Kate Rusby?
Bush.
A noisy gig venue or a quiet pub?
A quiet pub.
Good man. Forest or ocean?
Forest.
The British Library or the British Museum?
British Library.
Wall-to-wall sunlight or snow as far as the eye can see?
That's probably the most difficult one so far. Ideally, I'd have precisely 6 months of each. I really couldn't say either way. Let's say sunlight.
Let's say 6 months of each.
All right, exactly to the second.
Yeah. Start or finish?
Finish.
Devon or Cornwall?
Love them both. I've been to both fairly recently. You know what? I can't. They're both wonderful. I'm going to say, because I was there more recently, Devon.
Our next question should, it's not on the list, but it should be jam first or cream first?
Wow. Well, I got into the jam before I got into cream. In terms of toppings, it's cream then jam, right?
I'd say the other way around, but...
Okay.
That's just me. Whiskey or wine?
Wine.
Dusk or dawn?
Dusk.
Daphne or Velma?
Now you're asking.
I am.
Yeah, it's Daphne though, isn't it?
I don't know why you hesitated, really.
I don't know, I did, but my personal proclivities kicked in a little bit.
Let's leave that right there. Have you got any events, gigs, or anything you'd like to talk about? Anything upcoming?
Okay. In that case, this is going to be a very short section because I have nothing planned, no idea of what's going on in terms of the magazine, although they are doing events again, so there'll probably be something. There'll probably be some shindig club nights at the Night Owl in Finsbury Park. Yes, because that seems to be going quite well. Me personally, oh, I'll tell you what, I recently went to see the Horn Section performing live in Bath, and I've seen John Shuttleworth on stage quite recently, and hopefully it's all comedy gigs. I haven't really got any bands coming up, to be honest. Going to see funny stuff, I suppose. How long do we have to wait until some more groovy uncle music happens anyway?
Now, there's the question.
Yeah.
I couldn't possibly say because I have no idea.
Normally, I really enjoy your cyclical nature, if you don't mind me calling it that, whereby an album comes out and then you're putting them in the envelopes and then website's been updated and then people are getting them and it's getting played on internet radio and radio shows. And then you do that thing where you say, I've started writing some more songs. And then you do the thing where you say, I've started demoing some more songs. And then you do the thing where you're suddenly in the studio with people. And then it's like, I'm aiming to get this one out by April. And we've become used to this habitual thing.
But then the world changed, didn't it? So God knows. But, you know, do something sometime, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the way.
Which just leaves me to say, Andy Morton, thank you very much for joining me. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Glenn. It's been a blast. Happy New Year to you too. And I hope it isn't too long before we can meet up and go and try some pale ales.
Yeah, definitely. It's what you do. Thank you for listening to my podcast and I hope you enjoyed it. Andy Morton will be returning in the very near future to talk about Shindig magazine, and I hope you'll join us. See you next time.